But it said that soon I wouldn't have to.
That's wonderful, dear, said Bliss. After dinner, we'll see if the Alphans are as good as your Jemby was. Phelim's eyes sparkled, and pleasant thoughts of what was to follow carried her through a lavish dinner, despite the crowds and laughter and noise all about her. Only once, when a dish was accidentally upset, setting off shrieks of excitement fairly close to them, did Phelim look frightened. And Bliss promptly held her close in a warm and protective hug.
I wonder if we can arrange to eat by ourselves, she muttered to Pellaret. Otherwise, we'll have to get off this world. It's bad enough eating all this isolate animal protein, but I must be able to do it in peace.
It's only high spirits, said Pellaret, who would have endured anything within reason that he felt came under the heading of primitive behavior and beliefs. And then the dinner was over, and the announcement came that the music festival would soon begin. 82. The hall in which the music festival was to be held was about as large as the dining room, and there were folding seats, rather uncomfortable, Trevise found out, for about 150 people. As honored guests, the visitors were led to the front row, and various Alphans commented politely and favorably on their clothes. Both men were bare above the waist, and Trevise tightened his abdominal muscles whenever he thought of it, and stared down on occasion with complacent self-admiration at his dark-haired chest. Pellaret, in his ardent observation of everything about him, was indifferent to his own appearance. Bliss's blouse drew covert stares of puzzlement, but nothing was said concerning it. Trevise noted that the hall was only about half full, and that the large majority of the audience were women, since presumably so many men were out to sea. Pellaret nudged Trevise and whispered, "They have electricity." Trevise looked at the vertical tubes on the walls and at others on the ceiling. They were softly luminous. "Fluorescence," he said, "quite primitive." "Yes, but they do the job, and we've got those things in our rooms and in the outhouse. I thought they were just decorative. If we can find out how to work them, we won't have to stay in the dark." Bliss said irritably, "They might have told us." Pellaret said, "They thought we'd know, that anyone would know." Four women now emerged from behind screens and seated themselves in a group in the space at the front. Each held an instrument of varnished wood of a similar shape, but one that was not easily describable. The instruments were chiefly different in size. One was quite small, two somewhat larger, and the fourth considerably larger. Each woman also held a long rod in the other hand. The audience whistled softly as they came in response to which the four women bowed. Each had a strip of gauze bound fairly tightly across the breasts, as though to keep them from interfering with the instrument. Trevise, interpreting the whistles as signs of approval or of pleased anticipation, felt it only polite to add his own. At that, Phelim added a trill that was far more than a whistle, and that was beginning to attract attention when pressure from Bliss's hand stopped her. Three of the women, without preparation, put their instruments under their chins, while the largest of the instruments remained between the legs of the fourth woman and rested on the floor. The long rod in the right hand of each was sawed across the strings stretching nearly the length of the instrument, while the fingers of the left hand shifted rapidly along the upper ends of those strings. This, thought Trevise, was the scraping he had expected, but it didn't sound like scraping at all. There was a soft and melodious succession of notes, each instrument doing something of its own, and the whole fusing pleasantly. It lacked the infinite complexity of electronic music. Real music, as Trevise could not help but think of it. And there was a distinct sameness to it. Still, as time passed, and his ear grew accustomed to this odd system of sound, he began to pick out subtleties. It was wearisome to have to do so, and he thought longingly of the clamor and mathematical precision and purity of the real thing. But it occurred to him that if he listened to the music of these simple wooden devices long enough, he might well grow to like it. It was not till the concert was some 45 minutes old that Hiroko stepped out. She noticed Trevise in the front row at once and smiled at him. He joined the audience in the soft whistle of approval with a whole heart. She looked beautiful in a long and most elaborate skirt, a large flower in her hair, and nothing at all over her breasts, since apparently there was no danger of their interference with the instrument. Her instrument proved to be a dark wooden tube about 2/3 of a meter long and nearly 2 centimeters thick. She lifted the instrument to her lips and blew across an opening near one end, producing a thin, sweet note that wavered in pitch as her fingers manipulated metal objects along the length of the tube. At the first sound, Phelim clutched at Bliss's arm and said, "Bliss, that's a..." And the words sounded like feeful to Bliss. Bliss shook her head firmly at Phelim, who said in a lower voice, "But it is." Others were looking in Phelim's direction. Bliss put her hand firmly over Phelim's mouth and leaned down to mutter an almost subliminally forceful, "Quiet," into her ear. Phelim listened to Hiroko's playing quietly thereafter, but her fingers moved spasmodically, as though they were operating the objects along the length of the instrument. The final player in the concert was an elderly man who had an instrument with fluted sides suspended over his shoulders. He pulled it in and out, while one hand flashed across a succession of white and dark objects at one end, pressing them down in groups. Trevise found the sound particularly wearing, rather barbaric, and unpleasantly like the memory of the barking of the dogs on Aurora. Not that the sound was like barking, but the emotions it gave rise to were similar. Bliss looked as though she would like to place her hands over her ears, and Pellerat had a frown on his face. Only Phelim seemed to enjoy it, for she was tapping her foot lightly. And Trevise, when he noticed that, realized to his own surprise that there was a beat to the music that matched Phelim's footfall. It came to an end at last, and there was a perfect storm of whistling, with Phelim's trill clearly heard above it all. Then the audience broke up into small conversational groups and became as loud and raucous as Alphen seemed to be on all public occasions. The various individuals who had played in the concert stood about in front of the room and spoke to those people who came up to congratulate them. Phelim evaded Bliss's grasp and ran up to Hiroko. "Hiroko," she cried out gaspingly, "let me see the..."
"The what, dear one?" said Hiroko.
"The thing you made the music with."
"Oh," Hiroko laughed, "that's a flute, little one. May I see it?"
"Well..."
Hiroko opened a case and took out the instrument. It was in three parts, but she put it together quickly, held it toward Phelim with the mouthpiece near her lips, and said,
"There, blow thou thy breath across this." I know," said Phelim eagerly, and reached for the flute.
Automatically, Hiroko snatched it away and held it high.
"Blow, child, but touch not."
Phelim seemed disappointed.
"May I just look at it, then? I won't touch it."
"Certainly, dear one."
She held out the flute again, and Phelim stared at it earnestly.
And then the fluorescent lighting in the room dimmed very slightly, and the sound of a flute's note, a little uncertain and wavering, made itself heard. Hiroko, in surprise, nearly dropped the flute, and Phalum cried out,
"I did it! I did it! Jembe said someday I could do it."
Hiroko said, "Was it thou that made the sound?"
"Yes, I did. I did."
"But how didst thou do so, child?" Bliss said, red with embarrassment, "I'm sorry, Hiroko. I'll take her away."
"No," said Hiroko. "I wish her to do it again."
A few of the nearest Alphans had gathered to watch. Phalum furrowed her brow as though trying hard. The fluorescence dimmed rather more than before, and again there was the note of the flute, this time pure and steady. Then it became erratic as the metal objects along the length of the flute moved of their own accord.
"It's a little different from the..."
Phalum said a little breathlessly, as though the breath that had been activating the flute had been her own instead of power-driven air. Pellerat said to Trevise, "She must be getting the energy from the electric current that feeds the fluorescence."
"Try again," said Hiroko in a choked voice.
Phalum closed her eyes. The note was softer now and under firmer control. The flute played by itself, maneuvered by no fingers, but moved by distant energy, transduced through the still immature lobes of Phalum's brain. The notes, which began as almost random, settled into a musical succession. And now everyone in the hall had gathered around Hiroko and Phalum, as Hiroko held the flute gently with thumb and forefinger at either end, and Phalum, eyes closed, directed the current of air and the movement of the keys.
"It's the piece I played," whispered Hiroko.
"I remember it,"
said Phalum, nodding her head slightly, trying not to break her concentration.
"Thou didst not miss a note," said Hiroko, when it was done.
"But it's not right, Hiroko. You didn't do it right."
Bliss said,
"Phalum, that's not polite. You mustn't..."
"Please,"
said Hiroko peremptorily,
"do not interfere. Why is it not right, child?" "Because I would play it differently."
"Show me then."
Again the flute played, but in more complicated fashion. For the forces that pushed the keys did so more quickly, in more rapid succession, and in more elaborate combinations than before. The music was more complex, and infinitely more emotional and moving. Hiroko stood rigid, and there was not a sound to be heard anywhere in the room. Even after Phalum had finished playing, there was not a sound, until Hiroko drew a deep breath and said,
"Little one, hast thou ever played that before?"
"No," said Phalum. "Before this, I could only use my fingers, and I can't do my fingers like that."
Then, simply and with no trace of vaunting,
"No one can."
"Canst thou play anything else?"
"I can make something up."
"Dost thou mean improvise?" Phalum frowned at the word and looked toward Bliss. Bliss nodded, and Phalum said,
"Yes."
"Please do so then," said Hiroko.
Phalum paused and thought for a minute or two, then began slowly, in a very simple succession of notes, the whole being rather dreamy. The fluorescent lights dimmed and brightened as the amount of power exerted intensified and faded. No one seemed to notice, for it seemed to be the effect of the music rather than the cause, as though a ghostly electrical spirit were obeying the dictates of the sound waves.
The combination of notes then repeated itself a bit more loudly, then a bit more complexly, then in variations that, without ever losing the clearly heard basic combination, became more stirring and more exciting until it was almost impossible to breathe. And finally, it descended much more rapidly than it had ascended, and did so with the effect of a swooping dive that brought the listeners to ground level, while they still retained the feeling that they were high in the air. There followed sheer pandemonium that split the air, and even Trevise, who was used to a totally different kind of music, thought sadly, "And now I'll never hear that again." When a most reluctant quiet had returned, Hiroko held out her flute.
"Here, Phelim, this is thine."
Phelim reached for it eagerly, but Bliss caught hold of the child's outstretched arm and said,
"We can't take it, Hiroko. It's a valuable instrument."
"I have another, Bliss. Not quite as good, but that is how it should be. This instrument belongeth to the person who playeth it best. Never have I heard such music, and it would be wrong for me to own an instrument I cannot use to full potential. Would that I knew how the instrument could be made to play without being touched."
Phelim took the flute, and with an expression of deep content, held it tightly to her chest. 83. Each of the two rooms of their quarters were lit by one fluorescent light. The outhouse had a third. The lights were dim and were uncomfortable to read by, but at least the rooms were no longer dark. Yet they now lingered outside. The sky was full of stars, something that was always fascinating to a native of Terminus, where the night sky was all but starless, and in which only the faint, foreshortened cloud of the galaxy was prominent. Hiroko had accompanied them back to their chambers for fear they would get lost in the dark, or that they would stumble. All the way back, she held Phelim's hand, and then, after lighting the fluorescence for them, remained outside with them, still clutching at the youngster. Bliss tried again, for it was clear to her that Hiroko was in a state of difficult conflict of emotions.
"Really, Hiroko, we cannot take your flute."
"No, Phelim must have it."
But she seemed on edge just the same. Trevise continued to look at the sky. The night was truly dark, a darkness that was scarcely affected by the trickle of light from their own chambers, and much less so by the tiny sparks of other houses farther off. He said, "Hiroko, do you see that star that is so bright? What is it called?" Hiroko looked up casually and said, with no great appearance of interest,
"That's the companion."
"Why is it called that?"
"It circleth our sun every 80 standard years. It is an evening star at this time of year. Thou canst see it in the daytime, too, when it lieth above the horizon."
Good, thought Trevise. She's not totally ignorant of astronomy. He said, "Do you know that Alpha has another companion, a very small, dim one that's much, much farther away than that bright star? You can't see it without a telescope." He hadn't seen it himself, hadn't bothered to search for it, but the ship's computer had the information in its memory banks. She said indifferently,
"We were told that in school."
"But now, what about that one? You see those six stars in a zigzag line?"
Hiroko said, "That is Cassiopeia."
"Really?" said Trevise, startled. "Which star?"
"All of them. The whole zigzag. It is Cassiopeia."
"Why is it called that?"
I lack the knowledge. I know nothing of astronomy, respected Trevise.
Do you see the lowermost star in the zigzag, the one that's brighter than the other stars? What is that?
It is a star. I know not its name.
But except for the two companion stars, it's the closest of all the stars to Alpha. It is only a parsec away.
Hiroko said,
Sayest thou so? I know that not.
Might it not be the star about which Earth revolves?
Hiroko looked at the star with a faint flash of interest.
I know not. I have never heard any person say so.
Don't you think it might be?
How can I say? None knoweth where Earth might be. I must leave thee now. I will be taking my shift in the fields tomorrow morning before the beach festival. I'll see you all there, right after lunch. Yes? Yes?
Certainly, Hiroko. She left suddenly, half running in the dark. Trevise looked after her, then followed the others into the dimly lit cottage. He said,
Can you tell whether she was lying about Earth, Bliss?
Bliss shook her head.
I don't think she was.
Bliss shook her head. I don't think she was. She is under enormous tension, something I was not aware of until after the concert. It existed before you asked her about the stars.
Because she gave away her flute, then?
Perhaps. I can't tell.
She turned to Phelim.
Now, Phelim, I want you to go into your room. When you're ready for bed, go to the outhouse, use the potty, then wash your hands, your face, and your teeth.
I would like to play the flute, Bliss.
Just for a little while, and very quietly. Do you understand, Phelim? And you must stop when I tell you to.
Yes, Bliss.
The three were now alone, Bliss in the one chair, and the men sitting each on his cot. Bliss said,
Is there any point in staying on this planet any longer?
Trevise shrugged. We never did get to discuss Earth in connection with the ancient instruments, and we might find something there. It might also pay to wait for the fishing fleet to return. The men might know something the stay-at-homes don't.
Very unlikely, I think, said Bliss. Are you sure it's not Hiroko's dark eyes that hold you?
Trevise said impatiently, I don't understand, Bliss. What have you to do with what I choose to do? Why do you seem to arrogate to yourself the right of sitting in moral judgment on me?
I'm not concerned with your morals. The matter affects our expedition. You want to find Earth so that you can finally decide whether you are right in choosing Galaxia over isolate worlds. I want you to so decide. You say you need to visit Earth to make the decision, and you seem to be convinced that Earth revolves about that bright star in the sky. Let us go there, then. I admit it would be useful to have some information about it before we go, but it is clear to me that the information is not forthcoming here. I do not wish to remain simply because you enjoy Hiroko.
Perhaps we'll leave, said Trevise. Let me think about it, and Hiroko will play no part in my decision, I assure you.
Pellerat said, I feel we ought to move on to Earth, if only to see whether it is radioactive or not. I see no point in waiting longer.
Are you sure it's not Bliss's dark eyes that drive you? Said Trevise, a bit spitefully. Then, almost at once, No, I take that back, Janoff. I was just being childish. Still, this is a charming world, quite apart from Hiroko, and I must say that under other circumstances I would be tempted to remain indefinitely.
Don't you think, Bliss, that Alpha destroys your theory about isolates?
In what way?
Asked Bliss.
You've been maintaining that every truly isolated world turns dangerous and hostile.
Even Camporeon, said Bliss evenly, which is rather out of the main current of galactic activity, for all that it is in theory an associated power of the Foundation Federation.
But not Alpha. This world is totally isolated, but can you complain of their friendliness and hospitality? They feed us, clothe us, shelter us, put on festivals in our honor, urge us to stay on. What fault is there to find with them?
None, apparently. Hiroko even gives you her body.
Trevise said angrily, Bliss, what bothers you about that? She didn't give me her body. We gave each other our bodies. It was entirely mutual, entirely pleasurable. Nor can you say that you hesitate to give your body as it suits you.
Please, Bliss, said Pellerat. Golan is entirely right. There is no reason to object to his private pleasures.
As long as they don't affect us, said Bliss obdurately.
They do not affect us, said Trevise. We will leave, I assure you. A delay to search further for information will not be long.
Yet I don't trust isolates, said Bliss, even when they come bearing gifts.
Trevise flung up his arms. Reach a conclusion, then twist the evidence to fit. How like a...
Don't say it, said Bliss dangerously. I am not a woman. I am Gaia. It is Gaia, not I, who is uneasy. There is no reason to...
And at that point there was a scratching at the door. Trevise froze. What's that? He said in a low voice. Bliss shrugged lightly.
Open the door and see. You tell us this is a kindly world that offers no danger.
Nevertheless, Trevise hesitated, until a soft voice from the other side of the door called out softly,
Please, it is I.
It was Hiroko's voice. Trevise threw the door open. Hiroko entered quickly. Her cheeks were wet.
Close the door, she gasped.
What is it? Asked Bliss. Hiroko clutched at Trevise.
I could not stay away. I tried, but I endured it not. Go thou and all of you. Take the youngster with you quickly. Take the ship away, away from Alpha, while it is yet dark.
But why? Asked Trevise.
Because else wilt thou die, and all of you.
84. The three outworlders stared frozenly at Hiroko for a long moment. Then Trevise said,
Are you saying your people will kill us?
Hiroko said, as the tears rolled down her cheeks,
Thou art already on the road to death, respected Trevise, and the others with you. Long ago, those of learning devised a virus, harmless to us, but deadly to outworlders. We have been made immune.
She shook Trevise's arm in distraction.
Thou art infected.
How?
When we had our pleasure, it is one way.
Trevise said, But I feel entirely well.
The virus is as yet inactive. It will be made active when the fishing fleet returns. By our laws, all must decide on such a thing, even the men. All will surely decide it must be done, and we keep you here till that time, two mornings hence. Leave now while it is yet dark and none suspects.
Bliss said sharply,
Why do your people do this? For our safety. We are few and have much. We do not wish outworlders to intrude. If one cometh and then reporteth our lot, others will come. And so, when, once in a long while, a ship arriveth, we must make certain it leaveth not.
But then, said Trevise, why do you warn us away?
Ask not the reason. Nay, but I will tell you, since I hear it again. Listen.
From the next room they could hear Phelim playing softly and infinitely sweetly. Hiroko said,
I cannot bear the destruction of that music, for the young one will also die.
Treviz said sternly, Is that why you gave the flute to Phelim? Because you knew you would have it once again when she was dead? Hiroko looked horrified.
Nay, that was not in my mind. And when it came to mind at length, I knew it must not be done. Leave with the child, and with her take the flute, that I may never see it more. Thou wilt be safe back in space, and, left inactive, the virus now in thy body will die after a time. In return, I ask that none of you ever speak of this world, that none else may know of it.
We will not speak of it, said Treviz. Hiroko looked up. In a lower voice, she said,
May I not kiss thee once ere thou leavest?
Treviz said, No, I have been infected once, and surely that is enough. And then, a little less roughly, he added, Don't cry. People will ask why you are crying, and you'll be unable to reply. I'll forgive what you did to me, in view of your present effort to save us. Hiroko straightened, carefully wiped her cheeks with the back of her hands, took a deep breath, and said,
I thank thee for that,
and left quickly. Treviz said, We will put out the light, and we will wait a while, and then we will leave. Bliss, tell Phelim to stop playing her instrument. Remember to take the flute, of course. Then we will make our way to the ship, if we can find it in the dark.
I will find it, said Bliss. Clothing of mine is on board, and however dimly, that too is Gaia. Gaia will have no trouble finding Gaia.
And she vanished into her room to collect Phelim. Pellaret said, Do you suppose that they've managed to damage our ship in order to keep us on the planet? They lack the technology to do it, said Treviz grimly. When Bliss emerged, holding Phelim by the hand, Treviz put out the lights. They sat quietly in the dark for what seemed half the night, and might have been half an hour. Then Treviz slowly and silently opened the door. The sky seemed a bit more cloudy, but stars shone. High in the sky now was Cassiopeia, with what might be Earth's sun burning brightly at its lower tip. The air was still, and there was no sound. Carefully, Treviz stepped out, motioning the others to follow. One of his hands dropped, almost automatically, to the butt of his Nurani quip. He was sure he would not have to use it, but... Bliss took the lead, holding Pellerat's hand, who held Treviz's. Bliss's other hand held Phelim, and Phelim's other hand held the flute. Feeling gently with her feet in the nearly total darkness, Bliss guided the others toward where she felt, very weakly, the Gaia-ness of her clothing on board the far star. Part 7. Earth. Chapter 19. Radioactive. 85. The far star took off quietly, rising slowly through the atmosphere, leaving the dark island below. The few faint dots of light beneath them dimmed and vanished, and as the atmosphere grew thinner with height, the ship's speed grew greater, and the dots of light in the sky above them grew more numerous and brighter. Eventually, they looked down upon the planet Alpha, with only a crescent illuminated, and that crescent largely wreathed in clouds. Pellaret said,
I suppose they don't have an active space technology. They can't follow us.
I'm not sure that that cheers me up much, said Trevise, his face dour, his voice disheartened. I'm infected.
But with an inactive strain, said Bliss.
Still, it can be made active. They had a method. What is the method?
Bliss shrugged.
Hiroko said the virus, left inactive, would eventually die in a body unadapted to it, as yours is.
Yes, said Trevise angrily. How does she know that? For that matter, how do I know that Hiroko's statement wasn't a self-consoling lie?
And isn't it possible that the method of activation, whatever it is, might not be duplicated naturally? A particular chemical, a type of radiation, of who knows what? I may sicken suddenly, and then the three of you would die too. Or if it happens after we have reached a populated world, there may be a vicious pandemic which fleeing refugees would carry to other worlds.
He looked at Bliss. Is there something you can do about it?
Slowly, Bliss shook her head.
Not easily. There are parasites making up Gaia, microorganisms, worms. They are a benign part of the ecological balance. They live and contribute to the world consciousness, but never overgrow. They live without doing noticeable harm. The trouble is, Trevise, the virus that affects you is not part of Gaia.
You say, not easily, said Trevise, frowning. Under the circumstances, can you take the trouble to do it, even though it might be difficult? Can you locate the virus in me and destroy it? Can you, failing that, at least strengthen my defenses?
Do you realize what you ask, Trevise? I am not acquainted with the microscopic flora of your body. I might not easily tell a virus in the cells of your body from the normal genes inhabiting them. It would be even more difficult to distinguish between viruses your body is accustomed to and those with which Hiroko infected you. I will try to do it, Trevise, but it will take time, and I may not succeed.
Take time, said Trevise. Try.
Certainly, said Bliss.
Pellerat said, If Hiroko told the truth, Bliss, you might be able to find viruses that seem to be already diminishing in vitality, and you could accelerate their decline.
I could do that, said Bliss. It is a good thought.
You won't weaken, said Trevise. You will have to destroy precious bits of life when you kill those viruses, you know.
You are being sardonic, Trevise, said Bliss coolly. But, sardonic or not, you are pointing out a true difficulty. Still, I can scarcely fail to put you ahead of the virus. I will kill them if I have a chance, never fear. After all, even if I fail to consider you,
and her mouth twitched as though she were repressing a smile,
then certainly Pellerat and Phallum are also at risk, and you might feel more confidence in my feeling for them than in my feeling for you. You might even remember that I myself am at risk.
I have no faith in your self-love, muttered Trevise. You're perfectly ready to give up your life for some high motive. I'll accept your concern for Pellerat, however.
Then he said, I don't hear Phallum's flute. Is anything wrong with her?
No, said Bliss. She's asleep. A perfectly natural sleep that I had nothing to do with. And I would suggest that after you work out the jump to the star we think is Earth's sun, we all do likewise. I need it badly, and I suspect you do too, Trevise.
Yes, if I can manage.
You were right, you know, Bliss.
About what, Trevise?
About isolates. New Earth was not a paradise. however much it might have seemed like one. That hospitality, all that outgoing friendliness at first, was to put us off our guard so that one of us might be easily infected. And all the hospitality afterward, the festivals of this and that, were designed to keep us there till the fishing fleet returned and the activation could be carried through. And it would have worked but for Phelim and her music. It might be you were right there, too.
About Phelim?
Yes. I didn't want to take her along, and I've never been happy with her being on the ship. It was your doing, Bliss, that we have her here, and it was she who unwittingly saved us. And yet...
And yet what?
Despite that, I'm still uneasy at Phelim's presence. I don't know why.
If it will make you feel better, Trevise, I don't know that we can lay all the credit at Phelim's feet. Hiroko advanced Phelim's music as her excuse for committing what the other Alphans would surely consider to be an act of treason. She may even have believed this, but there was something in her mind in addition, something that I vaguely detected but could not surely identify, something that perhaps she was ashamed to let emerge into her conscious mind. I am under the impression that she felt a warmth for you and would not willingly see you die, regardless of Phelim and her music.
Do you really think so? Said Trevise, smiling slightly for the first time since they had left Alpha.
I think so. You must have a certain proficiency at dealing with women. You persuaded Minister Lizalor to allow us to take our ship and leave Camporeon, and you helped influence Hiroko to save our lives. Credit where it's due.
Trevise smiled more broadly. Well, if you say so. On to Earth, then. He disappeared into the pilot room with a step that was almost jaunty. Pellerat, lingering behind, said,
You soothed him after all, didn't you, Bliss?
No, Pellerat, I never touched his mind.
You certainly did when you pampered his male vanity so outrageously.
Entirely indirect, said Bliss, smiling.
Even so, thank you, Bliss.
86. After the jump, the star that might well be Earth's sun was still a tenth of a parsec away. It was the brightest object in the sky by far, but it was still no more than a star. Trevise kept its light filtered for ease of viewing and studied it somberly. He said, There seems no doubt that it is the virtual twin of Alpha, the star that New Earth circles. Yet Alpha is in the computer map, and this star is not. We don't have a name for this star. We aren't given its statistics. We lack any information concerning its planetary system, if it has one.
Pellerat said, Isn't that what we would expect if Earth circles this sun? Such a blackout of information would fit with the fact that all information about Earth seems to have been eliminated.
Yes, but it could also mean that it's a spacer world that just happened not to be on the list on the wall of the Melpomenian building. We can't be altogether sure that that list was complete. Or this star could be without planets, and therefore perhaps not worth listing on a computer map, which is primarily used for military and commercial purposes. Genoff, is there any legend that tells of Earth's sun being a mere parsec or so from a twin of itself?
Pellerat shook his head. I'm sorry, Golan, but no such legend occurs to me. There may be one, though. My memory isn't perfect. I'll search for it.
It's not important. Is there any name given to Earth's sun?
Some different names are given. I imagine there must be a name in each of the different languages.
I keep forgetting that Earth had many languages.
It must have had. It's the only way of making sense out of many of the legends.
Trevise said peevishly,
Well, then, what do we do? We can't tell anything about the planetary system from this distance, and we have to move closer. I would like to be cautious, but there's such a thing as excessive and unreasoning caution, and I see no evidence of possible danger. Presumably anything powerful enough to wipe the galaxy clean of information about Earth may be powerful enough to wipe us out even at this distance if they seriously did not wish to be located. But nothing's happened. It isn't rational to stay here forever on the mere possibility that something might happen if we move closer, is it? Bliss said, I take it the computer detects nothing that might be interpreted as dangerous. When I say I see no evidence of possible danger, it's the computer I'm relying on. I certainly can't see anything with the unaided eye. I wouldn't expect to. Then I take it you're just looking for support in making what you consider a risky decision. All right, then, I'm with you. We haven't come this far in order to turn back for no reason, have we? No, said Trevise. What do you say, Pellerat? Pellerat said, I'm willing to move on, if only out of curiosity. It would be unbearable to go back without knowing if we have found Earth. Well then, said Trevise, we're all agreed. Not all, said Pellerat. There's Phallum. Trevise looked astonished. Are you suggesting we consult the child? Of what value would her opinion be, even if she had one? Besides, all she would want would be to get back to her own world. Can you blame her for that? Asked Bliss warmly. And because the matter of Phallum had arisen, Trevise became aware of her flute, which was sounding in a rather stirring march rhythm. Listen to her, he said. Where has she ever heard anything in march rhythm? Perhaps Jemby played marches on the flute for her. Trevise shook his head. I doubt it. Dance rhythms, I should think. Lullabies. Listen, Phallum makes me uneasy. She learns too quickly. I help her, said Bliss. Remember that. And she's very intelligent, and she has been extraordinarily stimulated in the time she's been with us. New sensations have flooded her mind. She's seen space, different worlds, many people, all for the first time. Phallum's march music grew wilder and more richly barbaric. Trevise sighed and said, Well, she's here, and she's producing music that seems to breathe optimism and delight in adventure. I'll take that as her vote in favor of moving in more closely. Let us do so cautiously, then, and check this sun's planetary system. If any, said Bliss. Trevise smiled thinly. There's a planetary system. It's a bet. Choose your sum. 87. You lose, said Trevise abstractedly. How much money did you decide to bet? None. I never accepted the wager, said Bliss. Just as well. I wouldn't like to accept the money anyway. They were some 10 billion kilometers from the sun. It was still starlike, but it was nearly 1/4,000th as bright as the average sun would have been when viewed from the surface of a habitable planet. We can see two planets under magnification right now, said Trevise. From their measured diameters and from the spectrum of the reflected light, they are clearly gas giants. The ship was well outside the planetary plane, and Bliss and Pellerat, staring over Trevise's shoulder at the viewscreen, found themselves looking at two tiny crescents of greenish light. The smaller was in the somewhat thicker phase of the two. Trevise said, Genoff, it is correct, isn't it, that Earth's sun is supposed to have four gas giants? According to the legends, yes, said Pellerat. The nearest of the four to the sun is the largest, and the second nearest has rings, right? Large, prominent rings, Golan. Yes. Just the same, old chap, you have to allow for exaggeration in the telling and retelling of a legend. If we should not find a planet with an extraordinary ring system, I don't think we ought to let that count seriously against this being Earth's star. Nevertheless, the two we see may be the farthest, and the two nearer ones may well be on the other side of the sun and too far to be easily located against the background of stars. We'll have to move still closer and beyond the sun to the other side. Can that be done in the presence of the star's nearby mass? With reasonable caution, the computer can do it, I'm sure. If it judges the danger to be too great, however, it will refuse to budge us, and we can then move in cautious, smaller steps. His mind directed the computer, and the star field on the viewscreen changed. The star brightened sharply, and then moved off the viewscreen as the computer, following directions, scanned the sky for another gas giant. It did so successfully. All three onlookers stiffened and stared, while Trevise's mind, almost helpless with astonishment, fumbled at the computer to direct further magnification. "Incredible!" gasped Bliss. 88. A gas giant was in view, seen at an angle that allowed most of it to be sunlit. About it there curved a broad and brilliant ring of material, tipped so as to catch the sunlight on the side being viewed. It was brighter than the planet itself, and along it, one-third of the way in toward the planet, was a narrow dividing line. Trevise threw in a request for maximum enhancement, and the ring became ringlets, narrow and concentric, glittering in the sunlight. Only a portion of the ring system was visible on the viewscreen, and the planet itself had moved off. A further direction from Trevise, and one corner of the screen marked itself off and showed within itself a miniature of the planet and rings under lesser magnification. "Is that sort of thing common?" asked Bliss, awed. "No," said Trevise. "Almost every gas giant has rings of debris, but they tend to be faint and narrow. I once saw one in which the rings were narrow but quite bright. But I never saw anything like this, or heard of it either." Pellerat said, "That's clearly the ringed giant the legends speak of. If this is really unique..." "Really unique, as far as I know, or as far as the computer knows," said Trevise. "Then this must be the planetary system containing Earth. Surely no one could invent such a planet. It would have had to have been seen to be described." Trevise said, "I'm prepared to believe just about anything your legends say now. This is the sixth planet, and Earth would be the third." "Right, Golan. Then I would say we were less than 1.5 billion kilometers from Earth, and we haven't been stopped. Gaia stopped us when we approached." Bliss said, "You were closer to Gaia when you were stopped." "Ah," said Trevise, "but it's my opinion Earth is more powerful than Gaia, and I take this to be a good sign. If we are not stopped, it may be that Earth does not object to our approach." "Or that there is no Earth," said Bliss. "Do you care to bet this time?" asked Trevise grimly. "What I think Bliss means," put in Pellerat, "is that Earth may be radioactive, as everyone seems to think, and that no one stops us because there is no life on Earth." "No," said Trevise violently, "I'll believe everything that's said about Earth but that. We'll just close in on Earth and see for ourselves. And I have the feeling we won't be stopped." 89. The gas giants were well behind. An asteroid belt lay just inside the gas giant nearest the sun. That gas giant was the largest and most massive, just as the legend said. Inside the asteroid belt were four planets. Trevise studied them carefully. The third is the largest. The size is appropriate, and the distance from the sun is appropriate. It could be habitable. Pellerat caught what seemed to be a note of uncertainty in Trevise's words. He said, "Does it have an atmosphere?" "Oh, yes," said Trevise. "The second, third, and fourth planets all have atmospheres. And, as in the old children's tale, the second's is too dense, the fourth's is not dense enough, but the third's is just right." "Do you think it might be Earth, then?" "Think," said Trevise, almost explosively. "I don't have to think. It is Earth. It has the giant satellite you told me of." "It has?" And Pellerat's face broke into a wider smile than any that Trevise had ever seen upon it. "Absolutely. Here, look at it under maximum magnification." Pellerat saw two crescents, one distinctly larger and brighter than the other. "Is that smaller one the satellite?" he asked. "Yes. It's rather farther from the planet than one might expect, but it's definitely revolving about it. It's only the size of a small planet. In fact, it's smaller than any of the four inner planets circling the sun. Still, it's large for a satellite. It's at least 2,000 kilometers in diameter, which makes it in the size range of the large satellites that revolve about gas giants." "No larger?" Pellerat seemed disappointed. "Then it's not a giant satellite." "Yes, it is. A satellite with a diameter of 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers that is circling an enormous gas giant is one thing. That same satellite circling a small, rocky, habitable planet is quite another. That satellite has a diameter over a quarter that of Earth. Where have you heard of such near parity involving a habitable planet?" Pellerat said timidly, "I know very little of such things." Trevise said, "Then take my word for it, Janoff. It's unique. We're looking at something that is practically a double planet, and there are few habitable planets that have anything more than pebbles orbiting them. Janoff, if you consider that gas giant with its enormous ring system in sixth place, and this planet with its enormous satellite in third, both of which your legends told you about, against all credibility before you ever saw them, then that world you're looking at must be Earth. It cannot conceivably be anything else. We've found it, Janoff. We've found it." 90. They were on the second day of their coasting progress toward Earth, and Bliss yawned over the dinner meal. She said, "It seems to me we've spent more time coasting toward and away from planets than anything else. We've spent weeks at it, literally." "Partly," said Trevise, "that's because jumps are dangerous too close to a star. And in this case, we're moving very slowly because I do not wish to advance into possible danger too quickly." "I thought you said you had the feeling we would not be stopped." "So I do. But I don't want to stake everything on a feeling." Trevise looked at the contents of the spoon before putting it into his mouth and said, "You know, I miss the fish we had on Alpha. We only had three meals there." "A pity," agreed Pellerat. "Well," said Bliss, "we visited five worlds and had to leave each one of them so hurriedly that we never had time to add to our food supplies and introduce variety. Even when the world had food to offer, as did Camporeon and Alpha, and, presumably..." She did not complete the sentence, for Phalum, looking up quickly, finished it for her.
"Solaria, could you get no food there? There is plenty of food there, as much as on Alpha, and better, too."
I know that, Phelim, said Bliss. There was just no time. Phelim stared at her solemnly.
Will I ever...